Welcome back to the Move Podcast. I'm JB Hager, joined by Johan Berniel and Spencer Martin. And today, another first for the Move Podcast, talking about Tour of the Alps. Before we get to that, we do want to check in with Lance and hear from a couple of our sponsors and some special offers.
My favorite, George's favorite, Manscaped. Manscaped. Look, the man travels with his Manscaped. He's even got the case. These guys, they never sent me the travel case. He's got his Manscaped thing. I'm still working on him over here on the silhouette where George does the full shave down.
Well,
we are going to make this happen.
Had you let me rub the good on your face, I might have thought about it.
Oh, you didn't say that before. Here's a little bit of cool news. As much as I love this brand, but they're really doing something near and dear to my heart. April is Testicular Cancer Awareness Month. I don't know if you, JB, do you know that?
Did not know.
So they're super involved, helping to raise funds for a great cause. They are the leaders in below the waist grooming. They're partnering with the Testicular Cancer Society to remind you to check your golden nuggets this month for anything not so golden. And while you're down there, this is amazing. Shave your balls while you save your balls. I should actually, as I'm reading that, it might be a slightly different read. So let's support a good cause and go to manscaped.com. Use the code THEMOVE to get 20% off plus free shipping. Again, that's manscaped.com and use the code THEMOVE. And again, April is National Testicular Cancer Awareness Month.
And very important, they're donating $50K to their longtime partner, Testicular Cancer Society.
That's amazing. Thanks for, on a serious note, really, Manscaped, thank you so much. Awfully important, especially young men out there. You think you're invincible. You're not. So head on over to manscaped.com. Use the code THEMOVE. Get you 20% off. Today's show also brought to you by HVMN. We talk about it all the time. This is the go-to ketone for this Peloton and certainly for this show. It is a game changer, whether you're looking for recovery or performance or mental clarity, right? This is the crazy thing for me. And I know, JB, you've touched on this a lot and are a firm believer with whether we call it COVID brain or just, a hangover from South by Southwest. Ketone IQ and HVMN have changed the game. It actually crosses the blood-brain barrier, which is very hard to do for all you people that know about those things. Again, 60% of the Peloton is using it. Total game changer. Head on over to hvmn.com. Use the promo code THEMOVE. That gets you 20% off. hvmn.com, promo code THEMOVE.
All right. Before we get into the Tour of the Alps, I just did a quick search and then I kind of had to stop myself because I've got two encyclopedias of cycling here with me on the show. And I'm sure you guys know the history of Tour of the Alps. I'd like to hear more about it because the one thing I did see is it's only been called Tour of the Alps for a handful of years, but it has a history going back to 1962. And in bike racing world, that's still kind of a young race, right? Most of the ones we talk about are 100 years old. So give us a little history of this race and why it's important.
Yeah, I mean, I can say if I remember correctly, I think I did this race. Back in the days, it was called Tour of Trentino, Giro del Trentino, which is the area where the Tour of the Alps takes place. They speak Italian, but also sometimes German. It's close to Austria. And what I remember when I did it, I think 91, it was, as it is now, the preparation race for the Italians for the Giro. Now, back then there was a lot of Italian teams, like a lot. I'm not gonna exaggerate, maybe 10, 15 Italian teams. So I did it on Lotto, and I remember Gianni Bugno won the race when I raced it, and then he won the Giro. And if I'm not mistaken, I think he was actually in pink from start to finish in that Giro that he won. So yeah, I mean, a few years ago when I saw Tour of the Alps, I also had to. I said, "What is this race?" You know, and then finally I found out it was Tour of Trentino. But it's a hard race. It's specifically designed to prepare the teams for the Giro, and They do some really good mountain stages. I would say probably nowadays, the way cycling has changed, the big favorites of the Giro were not there, or the teams were not there. But I think it's still really a nice race to it. I think it's one of those races where there's enough quality and then also enough of other smaller teams who have the ambition to show themselves to make it really an attractive race. And sometimes you can see new talent in that race. One of those riders, I think we saw in the other day in a breakaway, a 19-year-old Italian on Green Project, Bardiani, really good rider. Didn't win the stage, but you know what he showed was amazing. And I mean, I think it's the right place on the calendar. Also, it's one of those races where, as a team, this is one of the only races where you can go to prepare and to race to get the rhythm. You know, there's enough off time, I think, and especially with a dominant team as Ineos was this year, there was kind of, they set the tone from stage in the first two stages, and then everybody said, okay, you know, we're going to go for our chances, but we will basically undergo the law of Ineos, or what Ineos wants to do with this race.
Is this race always all climbs like that, mountain stages, or is it sometimes throw in a time trial? I don't know the history of it.
No,
it was there's a lot of climbing.
I don't think I've ever seen a sprint stage.
So it's a good opportunity for pure climbers to go get some success and not have to worry about sprint stages or time trials, correct?
Yeah. I mean, it's all mountains there. I mean, one other thing that I forgot to say is that I do remember as a child, I went to this area a lot with my parents too. We went skiing there in that area. So, you know, it's very, very difficult to have easy stages there. If you look around and it's all mountains.
Okay. Well, let's jump into what just wrapped up this morning. And let's start with talking about Theo Gegenhardt, who took the win. And I know that, Spencer, you're going to have a lot of thoughts on Ineos. After watching them this week.
Yeah. I'll save those for, I mean, this is an amazing win from Theo. Like, he looked incredible. For example, Hugh Carthy was second, 22 seconds back. You might think, well, that's not that big of a victory. Well, when there's no time trials and it's only five stages, that is a big victory, because if you go down to Lorenzo Fortunato in fifth, there's actually a smaller gap between second and fifth than there is first and second. So Theo was, I mean, really dominant. Like, the first two stages, he won just like, it was like we were watching a race in 2015. Ineos was on the front, lining it out. No one could attack, mowing down the breakaway. Theo wins the sprint, and he racked up so many time bonuses and probably scared everyone so much that no one even really attacked him the rest of the race. He just rode fairly uncontested. I think the start of stage three or no, start of stage four was a little saucy. There was some attacks, but after that, Ineos wrestled it under control, and Theo cruised to victory here. Like, they should change the name of this race to Tour of the Podium, the third place finisher at the Giro, because I think he's now emerged as probably my leading candidate to grab that third place behind Remco and Primoz.
Yeah, well, let's not forget, you know, I mean, Theo Gegenhardt, I think we already spoke about him in another podcast, if I remember correctly. It was the Tour of Valencia. He is on a different level than the last 2 years, Theo Gegenhardt. You know, he had crashes, he had, you know, certain circumstances that didn't allow him to perform to the best of his ability. And this year he is back to really being a guy who his team believes in, and his team designates him as the leader before the race. That was the case in Valencia. This was the case here. Having a guy like Sivakov on the team, who is an ex-winner of Tour of the Alps, and then on top of that, having Geraint Thomas, ex-Tour de France winner, and, you know, potentially being the leader of Ineos in the Giro. For this race, Theo Gegenhardt was the designated leader, of Ineos, and I think he has proven in the races before already that he has that form, and that, you know, he should probably be a protected rider. I mean, he not probably, for sure will be a protected rider in the Giro for Ineos. So it's really good to see him back at that level that we were used from seeing him, you know, when he won the Giro. And yeah, I mean, I agree with you. He's, you know, he should be considered as a podium candidate. You know, if you look at Remco and Roglic, it's, you know, it's fair to say, I think that they are a step higher than him. But then, you know, if you look at 3, 4, 5, 6, 7, that Theo's one of them.
Yeah, well, should we? So I should say Jack Haig got third. Hugh Carthy got second. Haig third, 28 seconds back. We can talk a little bit about him later. I feel like he's not quite captured maybe the form that he had at the 2021 Vuelta. And I think he had a bad crash last year. I was maybe a little, I'm maybe being overly critical, but I was a little disappointed in him here. And then I honestly, Johan, I'd never heard of the guy who got fourth. Jefferson
Cepeda.
Capeta.
Cepeda.
Yeah. Like amazing performance from him on EF. They found him, I think, on Drone Hopper. Great pickup. And then Lorenzo Fortunato.
Wait, what is that? What is a Drone Hopper?
Drone Hopper was the sponsor of an Italian team. It was, you know, it was the team of Gianni Savio. So a lot of South American talents come from that team. You know, most known is Egan Bernal. You know, Ivan Sosa comes from there. There's other guys who, and Drone Hopper was a sponsor, a Spanish startup company that finally, I mean, they came in big, you know, with big ambitions as a sponsor, but they couldn't honor their contractual obligations with the team, and the team went bust. So yeah, some talent came from that team. And I mean, Cepeda is, there's another, I think there's two Cepedas. There's Jefferson, I think, if I'm not mistaken, there's another guy, Jonathan.
Yeah, I know Jonathan Cepeda. And then,
yeah,
they're just coming out of the woodwork, the Cepeda brothers.
Yeah.
And this is another young rider we got a really good look at this week, 24 years old, Ecuadorian. One of the things I noticed, maybe we're getting ahead of ourselves here, but it's like EF's pulling things together. In my opinion, they've got some talent. They got some results. They won the last stage today with Simon Carr. How old of a guy is he?
That's Simon Carr. That was an amazing ride to win today. He's 24. Another rider who was on, he was on Nippo, which was Nippo Delco Provence, which was a French team. I think Simon Carr is British, but he grew up in France. Team goes bust. Nippo goes over to sponsor EF, and they just luck into this guy, and he ends up on their roster, and he's a stud. Like, he's done nothing but just rack up impressive results since he's come over.
Yeah, good climber. And last year he was on the team last year already, right?
And he got 11th at Strada. He just like came out of the gate so strong with 11th at Strada. He got 15th at San Sebastian. So maybe it wouldn't jump off the page at you, but if you're paying attention, like, oh, who's this guy? I've never seen him in the World Tour before, but comfortable.
These
right
races
away.
Are the races. These races, that's the stage where these guys can, you know, show what they have when they get the opportunity. And a guy like Simon Carr took the opportunity. Same, for example, as the Austrian guy, Mühlberger on Movistar. On stage four, you know, he took that opportunity, and it had been a really long time, he said, since he had won. But those kind of races are, you can see, obviously, it's important to win when you make it a goal as a team. But then on the other hand, you see that other teams are not taking it so seriously, and they're just there to get the competition kilometers in the legs.
Or sometimes is that opportunity presented because you have a situation with Theo Gegenhardt and Ineos controlling things, so they're going to let people who are not in contention go up the road and control it. So that's where they see the opportunity. It's like, that's a good scenario for them to have Ineos in control of the race, correct?
Yeah, I mean, you know, the three first stages were the hardest, were really hard. So there you could see, okay, stage one, Theo wins dominantly. Stage two confirms. Then stage three is the stage where they still try. You know, Bora took responsibility of the race with the hope that they could break the strength of Ineos and ultimately win with, they won the stage with Kemna, but probably they had hoped maybe that Gegenhardt would break and that Vlasov could win the overall. But then stage four and five are stages that where you can, you know, okay, this is the situation now. Ineos has this under control. They are going to let breaks go because in the first three stages, people have lost enough time. And that's when these guys go for their chances.
And Johan, did you notice, so Gregor Mühlberger, you know, he was like, Bora had this, it was like 2019, 2020 Bora. It was like, feel like every German or Austrian rider on that team was unbelievably strong. They've since maybe fallen on hard times. Some of these guys have gone to other teams. I was really impressed with Mühlberger. And then did you notice he beat this? What is going on with these Norwegians on this Uno X team? Or maybe some of them are Danish, but his name is like Torsten Tron. Right, like they just seem
difficult name to pronounce. Torsten Tron. I don't know how to pronounce in Norwegian. So forgive me for that. But, you know, they're coming out of everywhere. I'm not going to say they're coming out of nowhere. They're coming out of everywhere, these Norwegians. And the fact that this pure Norwegian team is, you know, there's, you know, apparently there's a lot of money behind it, a big potential. You know, now they got Christoph on the team. There's rumors now about... what's his name? The world champion time trial.
Tobias Foss.
Tobias Foss, you know, is most likely leaving Jumbo. For the moment, they're not talking about it, but I would not be surprised if, you know, X makes him a huge offer to be their, you know, complete leader. That would make a lot of sense. They have a lot of good riders. And, you know, deservingly, they had their invitation for the Tour de France. We're going to see this team in racing the Tour de France this year. And I think they deserve it. You know, they've come a long way.
Yeah, if you look at just if you go through all these level of races like this and look at the results, it feels like there's a Norwegian in the top 5 to 10 of almost all of them, and they're all on Uno X. Like, I think they're going to surprise a lot of people at the tour. They're not your normal up and coming team.
No, they're not. Definitely not.
Hmm. Spencer, I know you had some thoughts on Hugh Carthy and. Like he was obviously right there in contention, you know, second overall just by 22 seconds. But observations.
Sorry, JB. I mean, yeah. Don't want to interrupt, but talking about this rider, Torsten Trine, I'm going to try to pronounce his name correctly. did you hear about his special story?
No.
So last year he was, picked out for a doping control, a random control. And he passed the control, no problem. But in the analysis of, they saw something in the blood, and they, thanks to the doping control, they detected testicular cancer.
Oh, wow.
And he got treated for that, got cured, and now is back, you know, at a level, which, I mean, 1 year later, that's amazing.
Yeah, it is.
Wow.
Yeah.
And
it's amazing.
Yeah, that is. Yeah, that shows you it can't be good to be having your blood checked all the time. Mm-hmm. It's not. There are like, I think it was Ivan Basso. No.
Ivan Basso. So, yeah, yeah.
He like crashed, and then they found out when they were checking him out that he had testicular cancer. Yeah. And so EF had a good week, JB, just to start that off. I don't want to sound like a critic. Like getting second in the GC, winning a stage, like that's good. They can go home happy. You did mention that they're turning things around. It does seem like a double track where you have riders like Simon Carr, Caicedo. Is that how we're settling on that? Like riders like that doing well. And then it does seem like they have these established riders that maybe aren't doing so well. So it's a little bit of a mixed bag for them, but they can certainly be happy from this. One thing I've wondered about Carthy, if you guys watched the finish of that first stage, you know, he attacks way too early. It's not an attack. It's like he opens up the sprint. He's overgeared. It's like he just falls apart on this gear, gets blown by, and you think, well, I think this looks familiar. And you go back, you're like, yes, this has happened to him infinite times in the last 3 years.
Spencer, I think it's his style. That's just his style. You know, I mean, listen, he's super tall. He's super skinny legs. And then this massive gear. I mean, it looks like a spaghetti, right? But if you look, for example, on the stage in the Tour of Spain a few years ago when he won on Lagos de Covadonga, on Angliru.
Yeah.
Same thing, you know. But there he also came to the top, like to the top, put it on the big chain ring. Said, "What? Where this guy is going with these skinny sticks, right?" but he could move them around, and he won. I think that's just his style.
And that's his last World Tour win, was the Angliru, I believe, in 2020. You wonder, he's kind of, at that point, I thought maybe he could be a GC rider, actually perfect for a race like this. It's not really panned out. Like, is he just a stage hunter, you think, from now on? Because we saw him in some pretty strong breakaways of the Giro last year.
I think the way Carty is riding and has been riding the last few years, he's a guy for, you know, between 6th and 10th in a Grand Tour, like the Giro or the Vuelta, not the Tour de France, but the Giro, the Vuelta, like top 7, top 8, which is hard. You have to be a damn good bike rider. Now, you know, the question he has to ask himself is, okay, does he try to keep maintaining that kind of profile, or does he back off and tries to go for stages? He did it last year. He was at every break, and finally I don't think he won a stage.
He didn't win a stage, but
he was really strong.
Yeah,
going for stages.
I honestly feel like if you just told him, whenever you think about sprinting, wait and do it half as far from the finish, he probably would win more. He's always fallen apart with like 100 meters to go.
I think one of the things that obviously, you know, he knows that he's a guy who has to anticipate. Yeah, he needs to go early because he doesn't have the explosive power. So I think that's probably why you have the impression that he goes too early. But if he waits until the last 300 meters, then there's guys with more punch, with more explosivity that he definitely can't beat. So that's probably why he does these things. And it looks a bit funny, but
it does look fun. I know. I just, in my head, I'm thinking, you know, in your career as director, Johan, did you ever have to pull a rider aside and just specifically work on their form, like their style, their form? It just looks like a lot of wasted energy.
You can't change a guy's style. That's, yeah. You know, I mean, if not the guy, if that would be possible, then the guy who has been, for example, giving advice to Chris Froome should, you know, get a huge
fine. That's a good point.
You know, that's just the way they ride, and it's efficient for them. So listen, when they're professional, and especially after a number of years professional, that's their style. You know, there's not much that can be changed.
Yeah, you could say, have you noticed this? There's two chain rings on your bike, and you have a small one. You can actually shift into that.
There's a guy. I actually sent him a message a few days ago, Santiago Botero. You know, he was a Colombian cyclist in the Lance era. You know, was fourth in the Tour and won the King of the Mountains, I think, two times. This guy was always on the big chain ring, and you know, even in the mountains. And I saw a video on his social media. He's still on the big chain ring, you know, 20 years later. And I said, hey, Santi, you know, like after, you know, when you reach a certain age, you know, it's allowed to shift to the small chain ring. And he said, you know, it's just out of laziness. He just wants to stay on the big chain ring.
What other takeaways did you get from this Tour of Alps, Spencer?
Well, we should talk about Ineos as a team. So Bora actually... Ineos was the dominant team here. They dominated pretty much line to line. Borat came with a strong team. And we saw on stage three, like Ineos just mowed everyone down. Stage one, stage two, race pretty much over. Stage three, Bora had a little bit of a comeback. I thought they were really strong in that final climb. Leonard Komna attacks, wins the stage. They have two riders in the top five at one point. They pulled.
They did first and second on that stage, no?
First and second on the stage, yeah. At that point, you wonder – you know, maybe Gegenhardt was so strong, no one's beating him in those sprints, which would go back to the Carthy thing, where Carthy knows that Gegenhardt's so strong, he has to go early. You wonder, like, man, if they could have managed that a little bit better, could Kamna have been closer in the GC? Bora then pulls Vlasov from the race before stage five, despite being in the top 10 overall to go race Liège because they're out of riders. But Ineos, I mean, at that point, Ineos, no one was even close to them. If you watch stage five today, they were controlling that race for almost the entire stage. And you think, like, Geraint Thomas is considered one of the GC contenders for the Giro. And he was working, he was like third person. Like, you know, probably Sivakov was ahead of him. Arensman maybe at one point, even though Arensman didn't seem to be in the best of shape in the first few stages. So you have like Geraint Thomas, who won the Tour in 2018, on the front for a lot of this race, which shows you just like the depth that that team has.
Third in last year's Tour, by the way.
And actually, that was maybe the best GC ride of his career. I would say you could make an argument that that was better than his win in 2018. Is like, what's the plan here going into the Giro? So they have Gegenhardt, who was obviously amazing. Thomas, who, you know, he's been doing this long enough, you just have to trust that maybe he'll have better form by the time the Giro rolls around. Arensman, who's going to want a shot at the GC. Are they just going to keep having the same problem over and over again, where they have so many riders that can finish between, you know, third and fifth in a GC, like in a major Grand Tour? Or are they going to?
I think that's the problem they have, Spencer. They do not have this one guy who can rival with the very best. If you look at the Giro, you know, it's no secret, it's Remco and Roglic, the two main favorites, and they don't have anybody at that level. So what's the next best thing is to try to have a few guys close enough that maybe if something happens strategically, although race strategy is less and less important in nowadays cycling, but you know, if you have a guy in third and a guy in sixth and a guy in eighth, and one of those three guys gets into a move, you know, there could be a surprise. You know, I think that's their strength right now, the variety of good riders, but they do not have anybody who can rival with those two super champions. Don't want to take anything away from the qualities of Theo Gegenhardt. He is an ex-Giro winner after all. But, you know, I think it's safe to say that they're not at the level of those guys. So,
well, you guys have even said in fairly recently, like, Ineos, like, this is what they're made to do and they're comfortable doing, is controlling a race. Like, you said that even when they weren't in the lead, they seem to go into that mode and control the peloton. So when they have a leader, like, that's so natural for them. You've said that on numerous previous shows.
There's some riders on that team who only know how to do this. And that's, you know, so they're all also, you know, there's probably, there needs to be a change of, I'm not going to say mentality, but you know, the way they see racing, to race a bit differently, because sometimes I think that I've seen races, not in this race, but other races, I've seen races that say, what is Ineos doing? What are they doing? For who? You know, they're fighting in the front. And then I don't remember which race it was. I think it was actually one of the stages in Tour of Catalunya. They were taking control of the stage, like, they were going to blow everything apart. They had the leader. And then finally, there was 20 riders away on the last climb, not one Ineos.
Yeah.
You know, so that's obviously a change. But listen, speaking of Ineos, there's one rider I would like to highlight also. You know, I'm really happy to see him back at a level that we've seen him before, is Laurens De Plus. Super, super helper in the mountains, was on Jumbo Visma, did some amazing, amazing rides in the Tour de France when Kruiswijk was third, and then did some amazing rides for Roglic in Tour of UAE and stuff. Like, really the ideal helper in the climbs. Changed to Ineos, but didn't really find his form in the last year or 2 years. And this season, I've seen him already on several stages to be back pulling and setting a tempo where you know, there's 20 or 30 riders left. So I don't know if he does the Giro. I think he does. But we're going to see this guy pulling in the mountains quite a bit. Laurence De Plus.
I agree in theory that, yes, they have power and they have all these riders who could just stick around the top 10 and they can get them up the road. And that could pinch Pogacar or Roglic and Remco. The only pushback is, do we ever really see that from them? It seems like even when they're out, like they were doing a great job of controlling the pace on the final climb at this race. If Pogacar's here, what do you guys say? See you in the douches? He's just leaving them all and it wouldn't work. But it still seems like they try to do that anyway.
Spencer, that's the thing. You know, I mean, listen, if you do not have the guy who can finish the job, you can be as strong as you want as a team. There's going to be Remco, there's going to be Roglic, there's going to be, I mean, maybe someone else who's going to say, okay, great, you know, thank you very much, Ineos. Or, you know, oh, we don't worry. Ineos is going to do well anyway. So that I know that this has happened already in certain races. So, you know, what's really going on there sometimes, I don't know. But definitely for Tour of the Alps, they did a great job. They were strong. They raced, they pulled when they had to pull. And you know, it makes it easier also if you have a guy like Theo Gegenhardt who showed that, you know, he was relying on his team. And for example, in stage two, you know, then finally he ran out of teammates and then he was there to finish, to basically take control himself of the situation and narrow that gap with Kamna enough that it wasn't a threat for his leader's jersey. So, you know, a team is always as good as its leader. Sometimes, you know, Ineos races a bit differently. Even if they don't have a leader, they still race the same as if they had. But hey, you know, that's the way it is.
Do you guys ever do the thought experiment of if Roglic was ski jumping, Remco's playing professional soccer, Pogacar's, you know, writing poetry, whatever he does in his free time, this is what the biggest races would look like. Ineos would still be controlling Grand Tours, and these would be all the top riders. It's really only because there's four or five guys who are super, 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 super talented that this doesn't work all the time.
And what's really amazing also, Spencer, is that, you know, with that kind of history, that kind of resources, that kind of budget, that, and, you know, agree, they did have a lot of bad luck with a guy like Egan Bernal, you know, his accident. But it's crazy to think that they missed out on all of these guys. They don't have one of these guys on their team.
Yeah, that to me, that's the biggest, you know, problem you would point to. This might be too inside baseball, but I think for a long time they didn't have a scouting department. They just had this one Italian agent who would, and if we go back to Johnny Savio from Drone Hopper, his entire business model is finding talented riders, generally from South America, locking them into like 10-year contracts. And then their agent would also be the guy who was Ineos's business partner, essentially, would say, hey, I have a new rider for you, Egan Bernal, buy him out of his contract. And then Johnny Osavio gets a nice check. That's how he was making a living. And that
and
was
the
way they funneled.
Gets a nice check too.
Yeah, it's good for the agent. And it's good for the riders because they get a huge pay raise. And that's how they basically recruited all these riders for years and years. But the problem is a lot of the good riders were not coming through that funnel anymore. So they just whiffed on everybody.
Yeah. You know what? That's interesting. You probably don't have to go back very far. Was it only Ineos that had a big budget? You know, there was no, you know, UAE wasn't a big player.
Jumbo was not that big yet.
Right. No, were they the only ones who had the power to buy these people at the time? And now there's several.
Yeah. They paid a lot of money to some like really, really good riders who won big races. But on Ineos, they were just one other guy. You know, who could win, for example, a guy like Wout Poels has been for a number of years on Ineos. Great rider, won Liège-Bastogne-Liège, you know. But in the other races, he was the first lieutenant for Chris Froome sometimes, but he got paid as a leader on another team. So that was a bit, but, you know, I mean, now talking about Ineos, you know, and not wanting to be really critical, but I personally, now I'm just thinking about this. I think it's really, really strange to see that such a big sponsor with such a long commitment they don't have their own development team.
Yeah, I agree. And I think that's really hurt them.
Weird.
Yeah. They've just let that. And I think the idea was, we won't do a development team because we'll just see who's good. We don't even have to deal with these kids, and we'll just buy them. Once they've then proven themselves, we'll drop the bag. They come to us. The problem is, if everyone's finding them before you and locking them into five-year deals like Pogacar or Roglic at Jumbo, that doesn't work anymore. And I think they've been caught a little flat-footed by that.
Yeah. It was, I don't know if it was Ineos we were talking about months ago that has some kind of program in Africa. Was that Ineos?
Yes. They just started that.
Yeah.
That's kind of a new thing. Maybe they're banking on 3 to 5 years.
But that's because of their relationship with the marathon runner, Kipkoche. He's kind of the head of that and wants to find endurance athletes. And instead of, you know, pushing them towards running, putting them on bikes. And that should work. That should work. There's no reason why it shouldn't work, but that's a long-term project.
Right. Okay. Any other final thoughts here?
Yes. Spencer? Should we talk about Matthew? Is it Riccatello? Is that how you say the last name?
Yeah.
Riccatello, kind of a We Do House writer, I think is. I've had dinner with his family, so I'm biased. I'm a big fan. He gets 16th overall, third in the youth classification. I thought Israel, his team kind of botched the final stage. They let a young rider get in the breakaway. They tried to pull late. It was too late. So he got leapfrogged from second to third into third. He'll be fine, though, with that.
That's not really something you can, you know, second in the young classification. That's not really something that you can expect a team, which is already not the strongest team in the race. You know, they have to kind of look, okay, we have to be careful what we do. Otherwise, if we work too much, we lose the rider. But, you know, more than his place in GC, I think, you know, I've seen certain things from Matthew on I think stage two or stage three, probably stage two. You know, he was there, you know, with the seven, eight best riders on the climb. First year professional, you know, he's shown already in Argentina that he was, you know, good on the climbs. I think there he probably won the young classification or was second, but he did top 10 in the GC. And from what I hear from within his team, they are extremely, extremely happy and satisfied with him. Both his mentality and his results. So I think it's worth a real mention to, you know, to highlight his performance. Good things to come. And if my information is right, and I don't know if I can say this or not, but a little bird told me that he's going to the Giro.
Oh, I was just wondering about that. I'm excited. Yeah. I mean, he tacked on the final climb today, these are hard climbs. Even the non-high mountains in this region are brutal. And I was thinking, if you just replaced this little American flag with an Italian flag, I would have been like, oh, wow, this young prospect is going to go on to win the Giro. This guy's amazing. it's almost like his Americanism penalizes the excitement around him. But he just looks so strong on the bike. And I think the Giro is going to be a great race for him.
Yeah, 21 years old out of Tucson. He's probably wishing for some hotter weather.
He looked good, though, in the cold weather. I mean, I was really impressed by that.
There's this other rider. Let's see if I can find his name. It was on stage four. Here we go. Giulio Pellizzari, 19 years old. He should be in our up-and-comer show next year. What he did that day was really impressive. Don't know what's going to happen now to him, if they're going to put him in the Giro or not. That would be, I mean, that's not because all of a sudden you show one great result, but that's a name to remember. Giulio Pellizzari.
Yeah, that was with the three that went to the line, right?
Yes.
And he just got out sprinted.
I mean, Mulberger,
19 years old, geez.
Big strong guy, or I mean, he looks big and strong compared to the people he's in the breakaway with. So, kind of seemed like he had that under control. But that's a name I can get behind. Giulio Pellizzari. I'm already pumped about this guy.
He's born on the 21st of November 2003.
That's crazy.
I mean, wow. That's amazing.
I assume he won't be on, do you think he won't be on Bardiani next year? Will he go to a bigger team?
It depends. You know, I mean, probably he's obviously a new professional, I hope. let's see, 2002. Let's see. He was on Bardiani last year already.
Yeah, he was racing a pro schedule, like not.
Yeah, he was on Bardiani. Schedule. So wow. Normally he signed a 2-year contract, so he's going to be free of contract. So yeah, he's not going to be on Bardiani next year. Don't think so. We are not the only ones who have seen this guy's potential.
And you know what? The Lance and George aren't on the show, so you know you can be throwing that name out, and they'll be like, "God, Johan just." Where does he find all these young riders?
And they'll never listen. They'll never listen to this episode. Next,
in the up and comer show, he's going to say, "What? Who's the hell? Who the hell is this?"
Right? You can drop another name on him like that, and that'll be great. Okay, we'll go ahead and wrap up for today. Thank you very much, Johan and Spencer. We'll be back for Liège on Sunday, which is going to be exciting. Like, how big will that be in cycling history if Pogacar pulls off the 3 wins in a row?
I think he could.
There's high possibilities that it'll happen. You know, it would be him and Rebellin and Gilbert.
Yep.
Who would do that? Not even Eddy Merckx has done this. But then on the top of that, he would do this and a Tour de France winner and win Flanders. That's like a statistic that would be unique, right? So,
wow.
What we're going to say, it's a 50-50 chance, right? Although a race still has to be ridden, you know, it would be foolish to think that, you know, this is still bike racing. Two big favorites are Remco Evenepoel and Pogacar. It's even crazy nowadays to think that, you know, if you would have said this like 4 or 5 years ago, you said, no, Remco can't win. He didn't race. He comes from a training camp.
Yeah, yeah.
Now we just assume, and they've proven this over and over again, that the races they do are sometimes not as intensive as their training. And Remco has shown that whenever he comes from altitude, that he's flying. Like, last year when he came from altitude and he did San Sebastian, he destroyed the whole field. So, you know, it's in theory, it's hard to look for another cyclist than Pogacar and Remco to be the winner, but it's bike racing, you know, a lot of things can happen and it's possible that somebody else wins, but something special is going to have to happen. It's going to be super, super interesting. To see, I would say, you know, Pogacar would be normally the big favorite because he knows that he just needs to try to follow Remco. Remco needs to drop Pogacar to win, right? If Pogacar can stay with Remco on La Redoute and on La Rochefoucauld on the last climb, then, you know, Remco has also shown this year that he's gotten a lot faster in the sprint. But normally you would say Pogacar wins. So we'll see.
And historically, how many times have we seen Pogacar dropped? Once.
but also historically, we've seen a lot of head-to-heads of Remco against Pogacar. Not head-to-heads, but in the same race. And most of the time, Remco was in front of Pogacar.
Oh, I don't know. I have some stats on. We'll be unveiling these stats tomorrow on outcomes.
The last few months, you know.
Yeah, the World Championships would be the one that if you were a Remco believer, you would point to Worlds and say that's the model for winning this because Pogacar was free to follow him at Worlds and he didn't. Everyone probably should have known that was the winning move.
That's not the same race, Spencer. You know, it's countries. Pogacar was in Slovenian team. Remco went early, took a lot of riders by mistake, but by surprise because lack of radio communication. It's different racing, you know, it's different racing. But San Sebastian Pogacar was there.
Yeah, I think he might have been. What was his blood alcohol level the week after he won?
He was gassed.
Yes, he lost, but I would imagine he relaxed a little bit after.
Absolutely. Absolutely. Yeah. You know, they were definitely not on the same level physically. Pogacar was tired, empty, and not motivated. And Remco came in fresh and super motivated. So we'll see, you know. We're witnessing greatness in these races, and I'm sure Sunday is going to be another day. They predict bad weather, so that's in Pogacar's favor.
And we'll do a full preview of the race tomorrow on Outcomes.
Yeah. Yeah, you can get to Outcomes by getting a season pass, which you can get at wedo.team. I do also want to mention we are not ignoring the women's recent classics here. Mari and Allie will be on Monday with Demi Vollering, who won both Amstel and Flesch, which that should be a really interesting interview.
And also, JB, sorry to interrupt. Very, very high probability she also wins Liège.
Yeah, I was going to say the same.
Wouldn't that be something? And then they're going to have her on Monday. Wow, that could be really, really cool. And I do also
the way she won Flesch. I mean, I don't who can beat her in Liège. I don't know. She's on the strongest team by far, and I don't know. I mean, I don't know who can beat her.
I also want to mention, I know a lot of our listeners already jumped in and donated after I mentioned this a few days ago. We're teaming up with Operation Get Out again, and we're going to help another community just like we did in Uvalde. There's an area of Tennessee called Teleco Plains. One of our MOVE listeners told us about this this area. They do some work there trying to help this community. And, you know, most of these kids don't live in a traditional home setting. They're with grandparents or non-family members. There's a high level of poverty in this area. And we're going to do like we did in Uvalde. We're going to go in and put a lot of these kids on bikes who've never owned a bike. So $250 will buy a bike and a helmet for a kid. And you can do that at wedo.team. Just look on the menu bar and it'll say Bikes for Kids Teleco Plains. So if you have the means and would like to set up a kid with a bike and getting outdoors, please do that. We appreciate it. And we'll talk soon, guys. Thank you very much, Johan and Spencer. Appreciate it.
Thanks. Speak tomorrow, Spencer.
Yeah, I'll talk to you soon. Thanks for having me, JB.